This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 14 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as he always is Zachary Frueling. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the Voyager episode, Living Witness, and we're going to examine the concept of historical evidence. So, Zachary, are you ready to make a little history?
I am. I'm actually really glad we're talking about Voyager this week. I feel like we tend to focus on Star Trek: The Next Generation because of its really rich philosophical history, and we've emphasized the original series a bit, but we haven't really spent much time on Voyager. So I'm glad we're getting a chance to talk about a Voyager episode. And one of my favorites, Living Witness, is always a fun episode for me.
You know, interesting. I came across this episode, was watching it in preparation for the podcast, and this wouldn't have, a week ago, probably been on any of my lists of top Voyager episodes. It's just not, hasn't been one of my favorites. I probably watched the episode, I've done 4 comprehensive rewatches. I've probably watched the episode maybe a couple more times beyond that. And it was never real strong with me. But I got to tell you, in context of our discussion, it really grew on me. I was able to latch on to some of the philosophical issues that we're going to discuss, particularly the interpretation of history. And funny enough, I've been looking through Star Trek's 50 Years Special Edition and in Newsweek, and they actually have this episode listed as one of their top 10 Voyager episodes.
That's amazing. You know, for me, I really wouldn't have put it in my top 10. I've always thought of it a bit as maybe a mid-grade, mid to high-grade episode. Like I said, I sort of jokingly say it's one of my favorites. It's in my top 20 or 30, right? And Voyager is my favorite show. I'm a Voyager, as our friends Char and Tristan over on Trek FM's sister show here, To the Journey.
To the Journey!
Everyone who knows me knows that I'm a Voyager and kind of came to the network through To the Journey. So it's not one of my all-time favorites, not in my top 10, but it's easily in my top 20 or 30. And as I was thinking before the show about which episode we could cover tonight, you know, you and I talked before the show that we might want to, we had such a long episode last week. We really went, sort of over our time limit. We talked for an hour and 40 minutes, but this time we thought we'd try to have a shorter, more fun, lighthearted episode. And I was looking through the list of Voyager episodes and thinking that I wanted to do something a little outside the box, something that wasn't the low hanging fruit. I feel like some of the episodes we've covered so far are the low hanging fruit in philosophy. It's really easy to know what to talk about and easy to know what examples to use. And I wanted the challenge of trying to take an episode and kind of mine it for some philosophical content that wouldn't get top billing otherwise, unless we took the time to talk about it. So Living Witness, it's a fun episode. That's why I picked it.
Yeah, this is going to be a great discussion. Again, I probably wouldn't have really latched on to the philosophical fruit as you mentioned otherwise. But after looking at the episode with fresh eyes and looking at it in context of our discussion, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, it occurred to me, you know, we did a previous episode on scientific reasoning and on the rationality of religious experience versus scientific reasoning and whatnot. And as I was watching this episode, it occurred to me how similar historical reasoning is to those other types of reasoning, insofar as it's inductive reasoning. You know, historical reasoning is inherently inductive in the sense that the conclusions you draw aren't proven by necessity, or, you know, they don't have to be true. You're piecing together the most plausible or the most likely conclusion based on whatever historical evidence you've got. And so conclusions in that sphere are always more or less likely. You're never proving anything with absolute certainty, right? You weren't there to witness something firsthand. And even if you were there to witness something firsthand, you would have the problems of skepticism and solipsism, these sort of deeper metaphysical and epistemological problems that we've talked about previously. But, you know, assuming those are, you know, setting aside those more esoteric philosophical issues, if you weren't there to witness something directly, all you have is evidence sort of a couple of steps removed. You can piece together historical evidence based on whatever artifacts are left behind. You have pieces of eyewitness testimony that are more or less reliable or more or less biased. And you have to piece all of that together, weave it together into a story that is the most plausible or the most likely. So it's an interesting example of just a different type of reasoning besides purely strict deductive logical reasoning. And I think historical reasoning and even scientific reasoning falls into that category. In general, I would say there's a whole family of types of reasoning that fall into this category. Statistical reasoning falls in that category. Legal reasoning falls into that category. Historical reasoning, scientific reasoning. We talked about theological reasoning falling in that category. So this is just another variety of this very large class of inductive types of reasoning. And like I said, one that I think just doesn't get a lot of press in the talk of Star Trek and philosophy. So this will be a great episode.
Oh, indeed. It takes me back to a creative writing class that I took many years ago as a college student. And the assignment was handed out by the professor. We were given names and a little bit of background on the characters. And, you know, to the point that we were even given to some degree the plot points. And each of us had to write a story based on the information that we were all given. And everyone in the course received the exact same information. And, you know, we were given a word limit. And so it struck me as really bizarre how different each of the stories were, even though we had all been given the same pieces of the puzzle, how different the end result was. And this episode reminds me a lot of that because, you know, they're working off of information and kind of extrapolating and trying to make determinations as to how it all fits together as a story. And even the doctor, or rather the backup module, comes along and tries to correct the history. It's still, you know, I think he made the statement, you know, facts be damned, and basically said, who's to say that I even have it right? And I think sometimes our recollections even of events, for instance, what I did when I came home this evening from work, you know, I can go through the routine, but I can miss facts. And sometimes it's a point of view thing. I'm kind of going all Obi-Wan here, but I think sometimes point
of view.
What
kind of podcast is this? Is this a Star Wars podcast?
It's
keep it on Star Trek. Come on. Save that for the 602
it's
Club.
It's just a matter of your point of view.
I'm sorry. I couldn't resist.
Well, we've given Char, Tristan, and now Matt a shout out here. So, so let's start out with a little synopsis. Zachary, maybe some of our listeners haven't seen this particular episode from the, I believe, the fifth season of Voyager.
Yeah, I'm going to defer to you on that one, Mike, because you are a much better synopsis giver than I am. My synopses always end up sounding like I'm in third grade. So. By all means.
Okay. I said fifth season. I'm sorry, fourth season. Fourth season of Voyager. So what happens here? The episode opens up, and we find ourselves caught in a historical museum, and a holographic simulation is being viewed by some Kurian and Vaskan, two alien species that we meet here from the Delta Quadrant. And they're watching a simulation of events that help shape their history. These events occurred 700 years before this moment in time that we see here. And we see Voyager in a completely different light. It's referred to as a warship. It's very... If I can kind of draw a similarity, this episode is very parallel universe as far as Voyager goes.
Yeah, there's the running joke on the network that it is the closest thing Voyager has to a Mirror Universe episode.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed it is.
In fact, you might even think that it is a Mirror Universe episode, the way it starts out. It starts out very dark, and, you know, Janeway is being, you know, more darker and more sinister and more violent than we're used to seeing her. And it would be very easy to assume this is a Mirror Universe episode.
In fact, I think her character here in this particular episode might have been her inspiration for Red on Orange is the New Black.
That's fascinating. You know, I haven't really watched Orange is the New Black, but now I'm going to have to go check it out.
There's a little...
I'm such a Janeway fan too. You think I would have got that far eventually? I just
well,
haven't got
Kate Mulgrew.
It's only so many hours in the day.
Kate Mulgrew is just fabulous anyway, and I'm digging the gloves. But we're watching this this historical reenactment take place, and it's a very different Voyager than what all of us as fans know. And what has happened here, or at least what is being portrayed, is that Voyager has inserted itself in the middle of a dispute between the Vaskans and the Curians. And at the end of the day, Voyager, in order to leverage an opportunity to get back to the Alpha Quadrant through a wormhole, have taken arms against the Curians in favor of the Vaskans. And so they murder a Curian diplomat and his attaché in order to get home. In the midst of examining some of the artifacts that have been found, the Doctor is released from his backup module and has a very different take on the events that are being portrayed in this particular episode. And over the course of the episode, we see the variations of those events and how they play out. We see it cause some dispute here 700 years later among the Vaskans and the Curians. And at the end of the episode, we find out that the whole thing was a simulation of a simulation. Had to throw that in there.
Yeah, we should have covered this episode in our Metatrex episode on skepticism and the problem of the external
world.
Yeah,
there's a lot of...
You're led the entire way through this episode thinking that you're watching something real, and when you realize that too is a simulation.
Yeah, it's interesting to note that no one portrays their characters in this episode. Not even the Doctor.
Well, I know we're going to talk about the philosophy of this episode here in a minute, but you mentioned Orange is the New Black, but as I watch this episode, I can't help but think that the subtitle of this episode should have been Black is the New Purple, because everyone is wearing a black turtleneck instead of a purple slash
black
gray.
Black is the New Purple.
Depending on your color vision, turtleneck. So Black is the New Purple. I think
that should be our show title.
I know we keep giving away the show titles now. This is going to be our show title. It's because we crack ourselves up a little bit. So sorry, everyone. All right. So Black is the New Purple. But it also occurs to me, you know, one thing that's, again, we're going to talk about the philosophy here in a minute, but I love talking about this episode and just geeking out about it for a few minutes, because one thing that is interesting to me in this episode is this idea that the Doctor has a backup module. So, you know, the Doctor's perspective in this episode, you know, although, again, recognizing that too is a simulation, mm-hmm. but this is all done from the perspective of the Doctor's backup module that was somehow lost in the course of the interaction of Voyager with this planet. And then they reactivate the backup module. But it occurs to me, they make it awfully easy to clone the Doctor, right? If the Doctor has a backup module, can't they just make another backup module, another backup module? And why does any of the crew of Voyager have to work to do anything?
Oh, heck
anything?
No. They could all hang out. They could all hang out in the holodeck at Fairhaven and let the Doctor run the ship.
like that episode where the holograms are slave labor down in the cave. You know, they just could have, you know, 15 copies of the 50 or 100 copies of the Doctor's backup module, and, you know,
I'm surprised Tom Paris didn't think of that.
There could be a whole hierarchy of emergency command hologram,
emergency ensign hologram,
you know, rankings, emergency ensign hologram, exactly.
Emergency engineering hologram, emergency pilot hologram. We could go on and on and on. It would be fun.
So yeah, it's a fun episode. You know, for all those reasons, I just get a kick out of the weirdness of this episode, including it's really fun to see the actors doing something different than they normally do. Right, the actors get to play a different variety of their characters. They're a little more dark, a little more sinister. And, you know, it shows the range of all these actors. You know, I think that's one of the weaknesses of Star Trek in general, is you don't often get a lot of range of character action. And it shows that all the actors on Voyager are great character actors when they're
except
allowed to
poor Garrett Wong. I mean, they really did him a disservice in this episode. There's this scene where he's interrogating the Kurian, and you know he's smacking him around there, and you're thinking for a second, ooh, Harry Kim is you know kick butt in this episode, and he's slapping the guy around and gets in his face. He goes, I could do this all day. And he gets up and he backhands the guy, and then he grabs his hand. He's like, ow, maybe I can't.
Oh, my hand hurts.
Sorry, Garrett, that was not the most convincing piece of toughness we've ever seen.
Right. We love you though, Garrett. I think a few of the things that I really enjoyed about this. First of all, Tim Russ. I love Tim Russ. I love Tuvok. I love how Tuvok is played like this sinister mustache twirling, a little bit of a thug. He threw a little thug in there. I really enjoyed it. Interesting, Zachary. This was actually Tim Russ's directorial debut. This particular episode. And what a fun spin on Tuvok. I also really enjoyed the Borg stormtroopers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But it's funny you mentioned the mustache twirling aspect, because if this is going to be your directorial debut, you know, why not give a little, you know, twirl the mustache on screen just to kind of put your signature on the episode?
I like the scene where Janeway turns around. She goes, Mr. Tuvok, why do you always keep me waiting? And he just kind of smirks and he goes, sorry, Captain. Firing now. It's great.
Yeah, so there's some great stuff in this episode. We could spend an hour talking about that, but we should probably dive
but
in
we
and
are
talk
a
about
philosophy
the actual
podcast.
Topic of the show.
We are a philosophy podcast.
This would be great fodder for listeners who are listening to our show and haven't necessarily tuned into the rest of the shows on Trek.fm. This is just a quick reminder that Metatrex is only one show of many on Trek.fm. So be sure to find Trek.fm's other shows on iTunes or Stitcher, any of these other places you can get your podcast. And, you know, we have a dedicated show to Voyager called To the Journey. Our flagship show is The Ready Room, hosted by Trek.fm's founder, Christopher Brian Jones. And so be sure to check those out. You can find, if you want to, you know, hear about this episode in particular or any other Voyager episodes, check out To the Journey. They spent more than a little time talking about this episode and every other aspect of Voyager, and every fifth episode or so of the flagship show of the network, The Ready Room, focuses on a Voyager episode. So there are plenty of other chances to talk about the fun aspects of this episode, Living Witness, and Voyager in general. But we're going to talk about the philosophy of history through the lens of this episode. And as I was thinking about this, Mike, it occurred to me that, you know, I think the obvious issue of this episode is the idea that as you look back at historical evidence, you can always tell a different story for any piece of evidence that you have. Mm-hmm. And it occurs to me, this might be the reason that I also like another show. And people are going to laugh. It's a little embarrassing, but I really do like the show. Another show that I really like watching when I'm eating my dessert kind of thing. This is not my day-to-day TV watching, but I love the show Ancient Aliens. And the reason I love that show is because it reinforces the idea that for any given piece of evidence you have, you can always tell a radically different kind of story than the accepted story about how that evidence got to be the case. You can take something like the pyramids at Giza, right? Go, how did the pyramids get there? Oh, obviously it must have been aliens, right? Because we couldn't have done the thing with the levers and the pulleys and the ramps and however they actually built the pyramids. Mm-hmm. And they tell a different story that it tries to explain all the evidence. And of course, it's really silly and it's a gimmick and whatnot. It's not a serious show. But the point still holds, I think, that for any given piece of evidence, you can always tell a different story. And this issue comes up in legal reasoning and court cases, right? When you're, you know, when lawyers are debating, you know, the physical evidence is what it is. And, you know, people who know me know this, but, you know, people on the network may not. But I served as a juror on a murder trial a few years ago.
Oh.
And it was fascinating to watch the two lawyers for the case, the defense and the prosecution, give completely different interpretations of all the physical evidence that came up in the course of the trial. And that's true of legal reasoning in general, right? You know, you can't debate the physical facts in a way, right? You know, if there's a murder weapon or if there's a piece of bloody clothing or whatever, the actual physical evidence involved in a case, you can't debate those. They are what they are, but you can always debate how they got to be that way and the story that weaves them all together into a coherent picture of what really happened. And that strikes me that that's what's going on in this episode. There are pieces of evidence, physical pieces of evidence, right? You can't deny the Doctor's backup module. You can't deny the in the museum where the episode takes place in Living Witness, there are little pieces of Voyager scattered around the room, just little snippets, right? Just pieces of evidence that are physical evidence, and those are the way they are, right? The matter that makes up those artifacts is the way it is. But you can always tell a story about how those artifacts got to be the way they are, and the motivation behind the actions that led to those objects being there. And that is a question of interpretation. So for me, when I think about this episode, I think that the main issue is this question of how you weave together different pieces of evidence into a coherent story, and how do you find the middle ground between trying to give a sort of a true factual account of historical evidence, but also recognize the fact that historical reasoning is necessarily interpretive or inductive insofar as the evidence never fully explains the picture. You have to fill in the gaps or weave those pieces of evidence together, and you have to create a more coherent story than the pieces of evidence themselves. So finding the middle ground between a true historical account and how to weave together interpretation, and how to avoid letting it devolve into a purely subjective account of what I think history meant. You know, you still want some sense of objectivity in history, but you also want to recognize the fact that there is an interpretive element. So I know I've been talking for a couple minutes here, but it occurs to me that the philosophy of history is something like a hermeneutics problem.
Yeah.
You know, you've got reality the way it is, and then you've got the interpretation of historical events based on, you know, our fragmented, that could be more or less complete picture of historical evidence. And you have to find the intersection of trying to stick to reality as closely as possible while trying to fill in the gaps and be as accurate as possible.
Zachary,
are
you trying to draw a Venn diagram?
I am trying to draw a Venn diagram. So, you know, now I'm you know, to the camera here in front of me, I can see Mike on a camera. I'm sort of drawing little circles, and I'm saying, over on this side, there's, you know, there's historical evidence, and over on this side, there's all the things we don't know, and all the interpretations and perspectives. You know, there's the original perspectives of the actors in a historical context, then there's our perspective today, and you know, the historical picture that we weave is the intersection of those two Venn diagram circles. So yes, absolutely, you know that I like Venn diagrams, and I'm weaving together a Venn diagram of history.
You know, one of the things, and it goes right along with what you're saying, when we're talking about interpretation of facts, Quarren admits in this episode, there's so much, he said, that, you know, we don't know. And he refers to the Doctor, and it's where the title of the episode comes from, you know, you're a piece of living history. And it's interesting because he makes a journey, really, throughout the course of this episode, and he's kind of our point of view character to some degree, this character that we've never met. His journey is he goes from the beginning of the episode when he admits that there's so much that we don't know, but he's defending his historical model. He says, hey, these are reasonable extrapolations of the events, you know, and he kind of, out of the side of his mouth, he says, you know, okay, so we found a partial schematic in the ocean. It was badly corroded, but these are reasonable extrapolations. And then, you know, by the end of the episode, he's like, history has been abused. He said, you know, we keep blaming each other for what's happened in the past, and we can't rely on, you know, secondhand information and extrapolations. He makes a journey to accept a different interpretation, really, than what he's accepted pretty much his entire life.
It always strikes me in watching this episode, it feels like they don't have much evidence at all, and they've really, it's not that they filled in a few gaps, they've really filled in a lot of gaps.
And oh, yes.
They've managed to build an awfully complete picture of what Voyager was like, right? You know, they have an image of a holographic image of the bridge. They've got, you know, characters that are reasonably accurate and accurately portrayed with some of the details wrong. But if all they've managed to have is a schematic that they found, they've sure extrapolated an awful lot to build this picture they've built. And another thing you mentioned strikes me as interesting, the sense that the protagonist of the episode is really unwilling at first to abandon the historical interpretation that he's used to. And I think all of us are like this to some sense. And I almost can't imagine how it could be otherwise, right? When we think about what it's like to learn about history, right? You're told, not even secondhand, you're told many hands down that certain events happen. This is what they meant historically. Mm-hmm. This is how we got where we are as a society. And this is just part of the narrative of learning about yourself in relation to your society, in relation to history. And that forms a worldview, the backdrop against which we live our contemporary lives and against which current events happen. And so there's a couple things there. I think one is that the picture is so deeply entrenched in our background that we don't question it very easily. We tend to take it at face value that the picture we've received is an accurate picture.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's always true that that picture didn't come to us firsthand. We weren't there to witness those historical events. And all we can do is take the combination of the first person perspective, you know, whatever primary sources or whatever first person accounts we have of history, all we can do is take the significance of what those people thought about their own historical context, combine it with, you know, the historical context at every link along the chain, right? Take something, you know, in the Federation, you might have the perspective of Jonathan Archer being one of the founding persons involved in the creation of the Federation, right? There's his first person perspective, his log entries, all the first person sort of in universe primary sources that give us information about how the Federation came to be, looking back on it in the 23rd or 24th centuries. And so thankfully, you know, technology's progressed to the point where the volume and the quantity and the reliability of first person primary accounts has multiplied. And that's true in universe, I think. But then, you know, as history, as events move from current events to historical events, at every link of the chain, every year, every decade, every new textbook that's written, every new historian that decides to write or think about a historical event puts a slightly different spin, a different emphasis, draws different connections between historical events than happened previously. And because of that, the evolution of the historical perspective, I think, changes over time. And it raises this really interesting question. If I look back at historical events in the real universe, whether it's something as recent as September 11th, could be something as, you know, slightly more recent, like my grandfather's accounts of World War II, could be a long time ago, like, you know, the Civil War or the American Revolution. At every link of the chain, you have the perspectives of the people who are writing about that from their own time period, their own context. And that's true in universe, right? You know, when Picard learns about the founding of the Federation, what does he go to think about the historical significance of an event like that? You know, you can go back to the primary sources like Jonathan Archer's log entries. You can, if there's 23rd century historians who are writing back and interpreting the founding of the Federation for the 23rd century, someone in the 24th century can read that account and see what interpretation was happening in the 23rd century. And so in my mind, the challenge is really, you know, you want to simultaneously get as close as you can to the first person perspective, because those are the people that have an actual kind of eyewitness account. And if you can't do that, all you can do is weave together these competing interpretations, hopefully, which are well grounded in some sort of historical evidence. But at every turn, whether it's a person in the current events, in this episode, I'm thinking of, you know, the doctor is supposed to be someone who is actually there witnessing the actual historical events, right?
Right.
And it's interesting to me that the protagonist of the episode is not willing to accept the doctor's word for it at first, that he doesn't have the simulation correct. And that's because I think of this historical fact that even people who witness something firsthand might be biased. They might remember something inaccurately. They're stuck in their own context. And, you know, if we had a historical figure standing here right now, joining us on the podcast, right? Say we had George Washington here right now, or Benjamin Franklin, or some important figure in the history of American thought and events, you know, they would say, here's what's going on. Here's my take on things. Here's the significance of this revolution we're having. You might say, well, okay, that's a great narrative, but, you know, that's so limited to your own perspective, you don't necessarily see all the connections that you can make. And you can be a little skeptical of the first person perspective. And certainly in a court case, like I mentioned, I was on a jury for a murder trial. You know, this happens all the time, right? You know, someone stands up to give their testimony, and then the other side, the defense attorney or the prosecution, tries to sort of poke holes even in the first person accounts. Did you really see that? You know, were you biased in some way? You know, so even the first person perspective isn't necessarily reliable, much less if you're generations removed from historical events like we are inside the episode Living Witness. And so the hard question is, how can you get any reliable picture of what history was really like, given the fact that even primary sources can be biased? You know, like I said, the protagonist of the episode doubts the doctor's version of events. He says, you know, this is a reasonable extrapolation of all the evidence we have. I refuse to accept your first person account of this. Our picture's more coherent than your picture.
Yes.
And so given all of that, how can you be anything other than a total skeptic about any knowledge at all of what historical events were really like?
Yeah, and it was a complete flip-flop from his original statement when he was confronted, you know, what are you going to do with this new evidence? What if what the doctor has to say here differs from your account, from what you have extrapolated here? And he says, well, you know, I'll revise my interpretation. And those are easy words to say, but he says later in the episode, as far as the Curians are concerned, he said, you know, change doesn't come easily. I think that's probably true for all of us, Zachary, and you're exactly right. You make a great point. You know, when we're looking at historical evidence, we look at it through the lens of our own experiences. We draw our own conclusions. We look at things with our own worldview. You know, I for instance, might look at something through, you know, purely a biblical worldview. Someone else might, you know, look at something through the lens of, you know, a secular humanistic worldview.
You mean we don't look at everything through the Star Trek worldview?
And, you know, there are people out there, Zachary, who are going to look at things purely through a Star Trek worldview. You know, it's funny because and you talk about shows that you enjoy, you know, there are so many great programs out there that I enjoy, and I enjoy watching science fiction. And, you know, I'm completely stoked. X-Files, you know, is back out, and I know it's gotten mixed reviews, but I'm...
Did you catch the new episode yet? I've watched the first two episodes
already. I've seen the first two episodes.
And this is definitely related. You know, the very idea of a conspiracy theory means that the historical account may not be correct. There may be some other... interpretation of all the evidence and that's what's going on. And I don't want to give too many spoilers here, but that's essentially the premise of the new X-Files, that, you know, Mulder and Scully come to realize, from what I can tell so far, like I said, I've only seen two episodes, but they come to realize that the everything they've witnessed in doing the X-Files and their whether it's the canonical interpretation of historical events from Roswell on, or whether it's the progression of the X-Files and the things they've encountered over the last couple of decades, all of it may not actually be
yes.
true. And we don't know how it's going to unfold yet. So a show like X-Files or like Ancient Aliens that I mentioned are a great example of this kind of reasoning, that we can be very misled when it comes to you know, our accepted historical interpretations.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I can sit here and tell you about Valley Forge or the crossing of the Delaware, both significant historical events in the history of the United States. And I would probably, you know, draw glares from my history professor, but I can tell you about those events. And my history professor would probably come along and tell you in a completely different way, with a completely different perspective, a completely different interpretation of those events and what they meant. We can go back a generation and hear about Valley Forge from, say, you know, a grandparent or a parent. If we could bring George Washington into the room, put him on mic here, he would probably tell us something completely different. But here's the interesting thing. He would give us a first-person account of Valley Forge or the crossing of the Delaware. But then let's go the next step and let's bring, you know, just some unnamed person who participated in those events, and let's sit them down. And what you would have probably, Zachary, is a completely different take on those events and what they meant from a completely different point of view. And we do this in the Star Trek universe many times in many ways, looking at events through the eyes of various people. And probably one of my favorite and one of the most fun ways that we've done it in the Star Trek universe is to take, you know, Trials and Tribulations and really do what we did with, you know, the original you know, the original series episode, and then what we did with the DS9 30th anniversary celebration, and bang, you have now you have an episode from a completely point of view, a different point of view. So now, when I go back and I watch the original series Tribble episode, when those Tribbles are falling out of that chute on Captain Kirk's head, guess what? I know that it's Dax up there tossing them out.
And does that ruin it for you, or does that
doesn't
add
ruin
to
it for me? Yeah. It adds to it, because now I have a, and that's what they did. Our Stephen Baer did so brilliantly with his episode was he wove another perspective in it and didn't do anything to either episode.
Yeah, you're hitting on a few things there. I think one thing is just recognizing that, you know, for any piece of history you encounter, any historical event or any historical account, there's the things we know, and that's always going to be inherently incomplete, right? We don't have a mm-hmm. complete sort of God's eye, this is a Star Trek podcast, right? So a Q's eye perspective on...
Q's eye, okay.
A Q's eye perspective on the events, right? You know, seeing the totality of history, the totality of every perspective. Almost like, you know, this is a little bit of a tangent, but it's an interesting one. The philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche had a view that's called, now called perspectivism, the idea that reality is just made up of a bunch of different perspectives. There's no sort of one true universal account, but you can sort of look at this person's perspective or that person's perspective or this society's perspective or that society's perspective. And reality is in some sense just the sum total of these different perspectives. And when you're looking at historical events, you know, we have access to some perspectives, right? We have access to whatever first person accounts we have, but there's always another person in the room. There's the person, whether it's literally another person in the room who's another perspective on the event, the people whose perspectives didn't get recorded by history. Mm-hmm. And you know, unfortunately, history has maybe tended to focus on, you know, the important white guy figures in history and maybe not so much on other racial perspectives or other gender perspectives or, you know, mm-hmm. just the ordinary perspective, not the George Washingtons and the Ben Franklins or in universe, the Jonathan Archers and the James Kirks, right? The perspective of the ordinary ensign cleaning the bowels of the ship, right? Those mm-hmm. perspectives tend not to get recorded in the historical account. At least if they do, you have to go digging for them, right? They're not the main show. And so there's always, I think, a need to go trying to find perspectives that are different than the canonical perspectives.
Yeah.
And it occurs to me that this can be done in a really harmful way or in a really healthy, productive way that is authentic and helpful for increasing historical knowledge. The unhealthy way is what I would call historical revisionism, right? If your goal is to try to unravel the canonical account for some malicious purpose, right? To further your national interests or to further your individual interests. You know, this is not something that is productive to. It doesn't increase the historical knowledge, right? It's sort of an abuse of historical knowledge, trying mm-hmm. to explicitly overturn things that you know to be true. I guess maybe consciously or unconsciously. And so, and it's interesting as I think about this. Again, I'm making up some non-Star Trek connections here, but they're interesting ones. There is, I recently watched Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Great movie.
The most recent Indiana Jones movie. It's not my favorite, but there was an interesting line in that movie. I forget the antagonist character, the woman, I can't tell if she's a scientist. She's the Russian woman.
Okay. I know you're talking about.
I guess she's Ukrainian maybe. Yeah, I'm sorry. I can't remember off the top of my head, but the main, the bad woman in that movie, she has this line that she's going to help you know, Americans understand the true version of history. And there is this sense, if you look at societies that are unhealthy, you know, radically communist or radically socialist mm-hmm. or radically whatever, you know, fascist societies, there's this kind of historical revisionism that goes on. And now they're trying to retell the narrative mm-hmm. history to bolster their own national interests. And Star Trek touches on this a little bit. Like, I'm thinking of Star Trek VI, when the Klingons tell Captain Kirk, "You haven't read Shakespeare yes. until you've read Shakespeare in the original Klingon."
One of my favorite lines.
But this is something. But this is something Nazis used to do.
Yeah.
You know, they used to, you know, they used to say, you know, Shakespeare had our interests in mind, right? And trying to retell something like Shakespeare from the perspective of a Nazi right. perspective or from a Russian perspective, right? Co-opting these great achievements and trying to tell them in light of a certain national interest. And I saw a little bit of this in the most recent Olympics, which is now, what, 4 years ago, I guess, 2012. Mm-hmm. Before that Olympics, there was a presentation of the achievements of the that came from Russia, sort of technological and social achievements, and it was very interesting because it wasn't really inaccurate per se, but it really was presented in such a way that the Russians are totally responsible for the progress that we've seen in the history of the world. It was total propaganda, Chekhov. Right? Because yeah, it was Chekhov, right? Exactly. Everything's a Russian invention. But so you know, the joke that everything's a Russian invention is, you know, it's a joke inside the Trouble with Tribbles, right? You know, it gets a laugh out of everyone. We know it's being done for some light character development and some banter. But really, there is this negative shade of historical revisionism there that mm-hmm. you could really believe that, right? Chekhov could really believe that and be a revisionist and have these, you know, this Russian nationalism in mind. And so, you know, the abuse of history is revisionism. But the positive version of this is to try to fill in the historical tapestry, right? Given that our perspectives are always limited, you want as complete a picture of history as possible. So you want to fill in the gaps. You want to go finding evidence that gives you more information and more perspectives on the events in history, or finding new events in history to talk about that haven't been previously talked about. And I'm thinking here of, you know, one of my other hobbies, Mike, is, and yeah, I think you and I have talked before that you share this interest also. One of my other hobbies and interests besides Star Trek is genealogy. Yes. I enjoy going out and learning as much as I can about the lives that my ancestors and distant relatives and cousins live. And I'm simultaneously impressed and frustrated at what it's like to go out and try to find evidence of what, you know, your mm-hmm. ancestors' lives were like. On the one hand, I'm amazed at the paper trails that people really do leave behind. You can find letters, and you can find photographs, and you can find census forms, and you can find tax information and property ownership information. So
yes.
When you really start digging, people leave an awful lot of a paper trail behind. And at the same time, it's always incomplete. None of those things give you the first person perspective, what it was like to live those events, or what it was like to make the day-to-day decisions in life. You know, the character, the sort of first person, interesting, subjective, lived experience of those people is really lost unless it's written down in a journal or a diary or whatnot. And at the same time, like I said, there's so much information out there, and it you really can reconstruct the past in some way. It's not like the past is totally dead and gone. Like when I find all this information in my genealogy search, I can get a decent picture of someone's overall life. You know, the things they did for a living, where they lived, maybe some of the things they were interested in. Even better if there's some photographs to go along with it, and you piece all that together, and you can kind of get an incomplete but rich picture of someone's life. And yet I'm always disappointed at how much I don't know, right? I don't know what it was like to be those people. I don't know what their personalities were like. Mm-hmm. All the things we see inside Living Witness, right? The kind of character variation aspects, right?
Yeah.
Even if you knew that there was a Captain Janeway that existed, even if you knew there was this guy named Neelix who was a Talaxian, you know, even if you knew there was a Borg on board, you're going to get all the details wrong because you don't have that rich tapestry of first-person experience or first-person perspective. And that's what's going on in this episode. So, it's an interesting episode for me because it really does mirror my own kind of first-person genealogy quest to learn as much as I can about ancestors and distant relatives. You know, I'm amazed at how much you can piece together. I'm amazed society inside Living Witness was able to piece together a picture of Voyager based on what limited evidence they have. And they probably can make some reasonable extrapolations based on the things that they've seen. Maybe not to the extent that we see inside this, you know, somewhat ridiculous simulation of Ensign Kim and Chakotay beating up on beating up on someone inside the holodeck or is it inside the brig? I forget where they are.
I think it was in a brig.
It was in the brig. Okay. So, you know, beating up on someone in the brig, that didn't really happen, right? But they did have a lot of the details right, too. And I think history is always like that. But it always leaves you feeling a little empty. So, you know, in the worst case, and I think in this episode, you can kind of give these two interpretations of this episode, Living Witness. On the worst interpretation, this society is a historical revisionist society that's using this historical account as propaganda to further their own interests. And that comes up at the end, right? There's kind of a twist where, you know, one of the people in the museum asks the protagonist, how do you know this is really right? You know, it becomes a politicized issue.
Yes.
Based on the question of the victor's perspective versus other perspectives, right?
Well, Zachary, there's the saying, you know, to the victor go the spoils. And one of the spoils, I think, is the right or privilege, if you will, to write the history. And what we really see here is that actually in action, because the Curians have written the history from their own perspective to protect their own interests. And really, to some degree, they're using that history to keep the Vaskans subjugated, if you will.
And I have no doubt that there's probably some people in that society who are doing it intentionally, right? The history writers know what they're doing in some way. But, you know, the average person in that society may not realize that that's going on, right? They just accept the accepted historical account as true. They don't have a reason to question it. You know, they weren't there to witness the original events. They've never heard otherwise. They've never taken the time to think about other perspectives. So they just accept that as true. It doesn't necessarily make it malicious on the part of the individual people who believe a certain version of history. I think there are certainly people who purposely revise history to further their own interests, but I don't know if that's true of societies, people in societies at large, right? People, I think your average man on the street, so to speak, or, you know, person on the quarter of the ship isn't going to question history quite that deeply, maybe.
Well, there was a character, and I don't think she was given a name in the episode, but she was a Curian. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she watches the doctor's simulation, which is a completely different take on the events. And they did such a good job by taking the facts. I mean, the facts were consistent. The evidence was consistent, but how they fit together and piece together the narrative were very different. And so, you know, she's just watched the doctor's take on these events, and she's infuriated, and she's kind of in his face, and she's saying, you know, listen, you're going to pay for this. You know, we're going to make sure that you pay for this. And, you know, he just kind of stares ahead, and you can ask yourself the question.
He's like, so what? I'm just the backup module.
Yeah. Yeah. He just kind of staring off, you know, it's like, you know, excuse me while I go change my underwear. But you know, you can ask yourself the question, you know, is she sincere or is she part of a revisionist conspiracy? And, you know, there's no real answer to that question.
Yeah, we don't know. Right? We're not given enough information. We're not given enough information about the episode. Right?
Yeah, we're not told that. You know, is she part of a revisionist conspiracy, or, you know, is she sincere? And here's my point. You know, first of all, I think anytime, you know, we are looking at history and we're confronted with evidence that differs from our own perspective, we should always be wary of those who are silencing dissenting voices. And we kind of see that here. I mean, there's a real attempt here to silence the dissenting voice, the doctor's voice. And you know, in the midst of all of this, the Vaskans have risen up because, after all, they've seen, you know, pretty compelling evidence that the Curians have, you know, at best misinterpreted the historical evidence and, given a sense of false history. At worst, they have manipulated the facts in order to maintain the status quo.
But I think the problem is that When I think about historical reasoning in general, it's one of these weird situations where, you know, if you you have two competing perspectives, right? I mean, you have that in this episode. You've got the doctor's perspective and you've got I can never remember the name of the society because I'm so bad at that. What's the name of the society in question here?
The Vaskans and the Curians.
Yes, exactly. You know, the two perspectives in question, they contradict each other, but at the same time, they're both true. And I think that's one of the things that fascinates me so much about different historical perspectives. You can have differing accounts that contradict each other. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, different accounts can't be true, right? If there's a concrete factual claim that's being made, different accounts of that can't be true at the same time. But when it comes to the question of perspective and maybe the meaning of historical events, different perspectives can be true in that sense, right? The meaning that I find in a historical event, or the meaning that you find in a historical event, or the meaning that society A finds in a historical event versus the meaning society B finds in a historical event, those interpretive meanings can both be true at the same time. So now you've got an interesting case where the two perspectives in question, the doctor's perspective and the society's perspective, they can't both be true at the same time because they're different, but they can both be true at the same time because now we're talking about a question of interpretation, right? The effect that Voyager had on a society, however it's being used or misused by the people in question, by the society in question, there is an effect there that has significance for that society, and the significance is an interpretation of that event. It's not a purely factual account, in other words, mm-hmm. right? The purely factual account would be like names and dates, right? On this date, on this star date, Voyager showed up, and then on this date there was a meeting with the guy, and on this date this war happened, right?
Yeah.
That the purely factual account of history, that's everyone's like junior high or high school nightmare of a history class, right? Memorize the dates, memorize the names, repeat them back, and you've learned history, right? That's like a most uninspired way of thinking about history.
You make it sound so interesting too.
Yeah, it's terrible, right? That's part of the reason I didn't really care for history very much. Although I should say, I cannot say that because I did have a truly awesome history teacher, and if she's listening to this, Mrs. Wara, you were awesome because you weren't like this. So okay, I can't say paint that with a broad brushstroke, right? I can't revise my own experience of learning history.
Indeed.
But I was just going to say that, you know, the worst way of learning history is just names and dates, right? The more interesting, inspired way of learning history is to realize that historical events aren't just facts, that they have meaning, right? They have meaning in the time period, they have meaning for us, they have meaning in the future that we've yet to see because we don't know what connections are going to be made to future events. The long-term effects of an event are constantly unfolding, right? And I think we've seen this happen in our own lives. And again, I want to drive this point that I'm not like a historical revisionist here. I'm really not an Ancient Aliens conspiracy theorist kind of guy. That's not me, even though I like the show Ancient Aliens. What I'm saying is that what you can't see is the long-term effect or the long-term interpretation of an event until it unfolds, right? Mm-hmm. We can see connections now between September 11th, for example, in our own lives, in the last 15 years, while we're all adults, right? Between, say, September 11th and what's happening in the Middle East, right?
Yes.
That's an undeniable connection that we couldn't have seen 5 years ago or 10 years ago, right? Now we're starting to make new connections. And history is always like that. There's always long-term effects that you can tie back to past events, however far back, right? You can go all the way back to, okay, what are some of the new interpretations of Columbus landing in America, right? In the Americas. Right. Even in the 20th and 21st century, we've had new interpretations of that maybe paint it in a less favorable light or criticisms. And it's not that they undo the historical events, right? The names and the dates remain the same, right? So we're not revising the factual events. But what we can do is constantly circle back and ask about the meaning of those events for our lives or for the future or for people in the past. But And I think that's what's going on in this episode. Like, you can look back at Voyager showing up on this planet, and it's right for the society to keep circling back and say, what does this event, and they call it that in the episode, the Voyager event, right? I think one of the characters calls it the Voyager event.
Yes.
What does the Voyager event mean? And you can keep asking that interpretive question. And so in that sense, different interpretations can be true at the same time. Both the doctor's account of what he sees on Voyager is from a certain perspective, from his own, you know, you could call it limited, from his own limited take on what the significance of the Voyager event was. And this society in question has a different interpretation of the significance of the Voyager event. And again, in parentheses, that can be used or abused, right? It can be done in a revisionist sense or in a manipulative sense. Could be done in a very honest, intellectually honest historical quest kind of sense. But those interpretations can both be true. And what I mean by true is that they can both shed light on filling in the tapestry of what really did happen, right? Every new piece of evidence we uncover, you know, whether it's a letter from your ancestors or whether it's a letter from a historical figure like George Washington, say they uncovered a new log entry by Jonathan Archer, right? That would add to the tapestry, yes, that you could weave together to build the sense of what really happened. And all of them have to have a little asterisk next to them, right? All of these accounts come from a certain perspective,
right?
So you can never take any perspective at total face value. And I guess my deeper point is just that history is never purely a sense of fact, right? The names and dates are not what history is about, right? Yes, those are important because we want an accurate picture of actual events, but the interpretive aspect of history is just as important as the factual events, right? The mere fact that there was an American Revolution doesn't do justice to our sense that that was an important historical event for us as a society. The founding of the Federation happened on a certain star date, right? But that doesn't do justice to the fact that the Federation continues to look back on that as a significant event for the society they want to create. And so I guess my point is, it's the fact that societies look back at historical events and weave them into the narrative of the present is not necessarily a bad thing. That doesn't inherently make it revisionist, right?
Right.
That's what history is about, is circling back and finding new interpretations and new meaning, mm-hmm, in historical events, given that the long-term effects of an event aren't known until they unfold, right? I have no doubt that in 20 years or 50 years or 100 years, however long, you know, you and I are left on this planet, right, that we're going to learn something new about the significance of the events we've seen in our lifetime here in the early 21st century that we can't foresee yet. And it's right for us to keep circling back and finding new meaning in those events. That's why I do want to draw a Venn diagram, like, and kind of paint a hermeneutical picture of this. But I think the distinction between a negative sense of historical revisionism, where the goal is not intellectually honest and the goal is manipulative, that is something we should rightly criticize. Mm-hmm. And you can see that in this episode. But there are the ordinary historians that really do go out of their way to try to build as accurate of a picture of the past as possible. And the only way they can do that is to keep trying to find new evidence and new interpretations and new perspectives on these events that define the tapestry, the historical tapestry they've learned, you know, because otherwise you're sort of faced with a challenge of either just accepting the picture outright or rejecting it altogether. And you know, anyone who thinks about it for more than a minute will realize, wait, there's a lot to learn, right? You know, there's people that didn't get recorded. There's things that happened that we didn't learn about.
Right.
And it's right to go out and try to uncover as much as you can, with the caveat that none of those still, you know, complete the picture fully. It's an ongoing historical quest to try to fill in as much history as possible. I guess my point is just that you can do that honestly or dishonestly. And it's not clear, you know, who's doing, taking which approach inside this episode, Living Witness.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Zachary, we are rolling up on an hour. Any final thoughts?
Yeah. It's hard because there's really not much to this episode. I think it's a fairly lighthearted episode. It is, like I said, it's one of my top 20 or 30 in Voyager. I'm amazed that we found as much to talk about as we did. I think it's a great branching off point to start thinking about some of the difficulties in historical reasoning. And I guess I'm a little just disappointed at the way some of these discussions go. I think too often people appeal to the facts as a way of settling the issue, right? I see people sort of saying, you know, I'm trying to think how to put this. I see it in my own family even sometimes. I see people say, well, you know, this is just the way it is, and it's not, this is what happened, and anything that differs from this kind of received, mm-hmm, view that they have is something to immediately reject or something to criticize or something to be afraid of. And that always bothers me because it strikes me that, you know, that surely we can't have a complete picture, that we can't learn anything new about the past. That can't be right. There's always,
what, doctor, you're not an android?
That's right. There's always something new to uncover and something to learn. And the notion of just accepting the received view passively and blindly without, mm-hmm, continually circling back to question it, I mean, those are the people that can be manipulated and can be abused and can be drawn into this kind of revisionist history, right? And it bothers me. And I even saw something recently today. I'm trying to make as many connections as I can, because I think it's not so much that the episode is a terribly interesting philosophical episode, but it's, it to me, it, it it's significant about a great many intellectual issues that come up in a lot of different spheres. Just recently, I saw an article by, the scientist Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Okay.
And he was criticizing philosophy. It was sort of like the death of philosophy, right? Because he was saying that, you know, there are certain things that science does that produce sort of reliable knowledge that's empirically verifiable, where we don't keep circling back to question those things. Mm-hmm. Things like, we know that the sun is made of hydrogen and helium, right? That's not up for debate anymore. That's a question that's been settled thanks to what we've learned from science. And you can point to a bunch of these things, right? We know that gravity is why things fall. And we know that the orbit of the Earth is, you know, 93 million miles in radius, right? Whatever it is, right? The easy sort of low hanging fruit. And he was really kind of appealing to the simple sort of brute force facts. Like, once science has learned a fact, you don't circle back and question that fact is the way it is. And science is cumulative in the sense that, you know, as science uncovers something, that settles the issue. We don't have to think about interpretations. We don't have to think about the political meaning of it. You know, it's kind of this purely empirical, factual account of reality, and science is good at uncovering these things. And it occurred to me, I was like, wait a minute, science is not that simple. He's just, you know, grabbing onto the low-hanging fruit here. You know, even science has questions of different theories of theoretical physics, and mm-hmm. and there's unknowns that have yet to be discovered, and there's different theoretical interpretations of the very same facts, even within science itself. May not be a empirical questions, but they're interpretive questions. What kind of theory do we have to explain these facts? And it just struck me that that's a way simplistic account of what science really is. And that's not to say science doesn't uncover facts. It does, clearly. Like, we know that the sun is made of hydrogen and helium. We know that now. And to bring it back to the episode, you know, we know that on a certain star date, Voyager encountered this planet, right? But that's not what's interesting about those issues. You know, what's interesting is the different, theoretical ways of explaining those facts in science or in history. What's interesting are the interpretive questions. What do these events mean for us? What do they mean for other societies? What do they mean for this individual versus that individual? And those aren't questions of fact. And this question, this episode to me just does a really good job of raising the idea that when you're uncovering something in history or in any other discipline, whether it's philosophy or science or psychology, you know, the facts often aren't the most interesting thing in question. What matters is the theoretical interpretation of those facts. Or, to bring it back to history, what matters is the plausible or implausible or more likely or less likely or more fruitful or less fruitful interpretation of those facts. And this episode just makes that a really explicit issue, right? You know, this question pits interpretation versus interpretation and raises the really interesting question, how do you go about weeding through sea of competing interpretations mm-hmm. when you desperately want to uncover what really happened, recognizing that you can never do so fully and you're always sort of forced back into the sphere of interpretations. And this episode just makes it a really explicit challenge and makes it a fun episode at the same time. So that's my final thoughts. I think that these are important questions for any discipline you happen to be interested in. Any attempt to uncover the past should take interpretations into account, but you need to find a way to do it in a way that's not revisionist, in a way that's not purely subjective, right? You don't just want any interpretation of the of historical past events. You want plausible interpretations of historical events that really do help shed light on the rich tapestry of events that actually unfolded and what those mean for us or for people in the future or whatnot. And it's just never a question of fact. And so I think this episode is just an important episode for thinking in general, regardless of what you happen to be interested in thinking about. Any area of thought has this kind of interpretive question, and it's often that part that's the most interesting part of those areas of thought, not the facts themselves.
Yeah, and this is you're absolutely right. This is a lighthearted, fun episode. I really enjoyed going back and kind of watching it again and sort of rediscovering it. And I don't want to be a downer, but you know, we live in interesting times, and you know, I am someone who really enjoys a good conspiracy theory. I love to examine things in different lights and different perspectives, and that's what I enjoy about mm-hmm. conspiracy theories. But the interesting thing about the times that we're living in is that we have the capability, really, to be revisionist in the way that we view history, because we can create simulations that are very convincing. We can extrapolate, and you know, beware when someone says, "Well, it's safe to assume that." Mm-hmm. Whatever. We need to be wary of that, because there were a lot of assumptions made. For instance, we assume that Chakotay, as they say.
I love that those little details are there, because those are things that the writers could have glossed over, right? You know, they went out of their way to find little ways of tweaking reality in that episode to, you know, Chakotay. Even the way Chakotay is pronounced. I mean, I might not have thrown that in as a writer, but they packed in a lot of stuff.
How many takes to get that right, you know? You know, if his half face tattoo, and you know, the fact that well, it's safe to assume because there's a Borg on board, so let's interpret that Borg in a very classic way. And the Borg that we saw in the simulation was certainly nothing like the Seven of Nine that, you know, that we're still getting to know here in the fourth season of Voyager. So, you know, we live in interesting times where we're able to extrapolate and, you know, kind of gin up the facts based on assumptions. You know, we, for instance, know in this episode that Tedrin was murdered on board of Voyager in a conference room. Now, interesting here, very fascinating, you get to different sets of interpretations of those events. One in which Janeway shoots him in the back with a pulse rifle, and one in which the Vaskan ambassador shoots him, you know, in the midst of a conflict. Tedrin as a character, we see two very different people. It's fascinating because he kind of says the same thing, but the context was different from each of those simulations. So, you know, we have to look at context, and we kind of talked about that. And you know, when you look at history in context, or you look at history through the lens of a particular worldview, those events can oftentimes come off very differently in their scope and intent. So, you know, I think this particular episode raises some very, very interesting questions. And so, you know, even the Doctor finds himself at the end of this episode struggling, because, you know, here he is 700 years later in yet another interpretation of events. He finds himself still caught in the middle of, you know, this dispute between the Vaskans and the Kurians, and, you know, how all of this is going to play out for the future of their people. And he comes to a crossroads where, you know, the Vaskans have now broken in. There's, you know, there's a real threat here on a global scale of civil war. And so, you know, he's just going to kind of sit back, and he makes a decision. I'm going to take myself out of this situation. And he says to Karin, you know, facts be damned, names, dates, places, it's all open to interpretation. Who, you know, who's to say what really happened? He said, and ultimately, what difference does it make? And, you know, Karin says to him, rightly so, you know, Doctor, you were there. You can't deny what happened. And the Doctor says, I can and I will. He said, Tedrin was a martyr for your people, a hero, a symbol of your struggle for freedom. Who am I to wander in 700 years later and take that away from you? So, you know, there oftentimes, I think, is a temptation, if you will, you know, to back off when we stumble on a new factual piece of evidence. For instance, you know, you mentioned your love and appreciation for genealogy, and I share that. And, you know, you talked about the struggles. I've got, you know, parts of my family tree that I can trace back eons, and, you know, there are other parts of my family tree I can only get back a couple of generations.
Yeah, we're distant cousins, I think, by the way.
Yeah, I think
that's
you're
a frightening
right.
thought, isn't it?
I think you're right. And we both trace our genealogies back to Europe. So that's fascinating.
Yeah, on just an interesting side note, you know, I read someone did a statistical calculation on this, that you can take any two people of European ancestry, and if you go back an average of 700 years, you can find a common ancestor. Any two people with European ancestry, and on average, that's the way the numbers work out. And an even weirder fact is that if you go back to a certain point, anyone who was alive at a certain point is likely to be an ancestor of everyone who's living today.
And again,
that's it's a weird fact, but that's the way the numbers work out. And, you know, So, yeah, I don't know what that means, but it's interesting. We're probably cousins.
Again, I think it depends on the perspective that you're coming at that, how you interpret that fact. And that's a great little side note that really sort of fits into our discussion. You know, how you look at the world, how you look at, the history of the world, what lens you're looking through is going to make a difference on how you interpret that particular fact. So that's what's fun about this episode. You get to see a series of events and you get to see it through, you know, different contexts and different lenses, different interpretation of those events and how it all plays out. But at the end of the day, I think it's an important, a really important point that we just have to, we have to be willing. And I'm not saying that we have to be, you know, quick to jump on the bandwagon every time something, you know, some new fact comes to life or light or some new interpretation of events, come to the surface. But, you know, I do think that we need to be open to facts and we need to be willing, to open our eyes to new perspectives and new ways of looking at things. And I think in the end, we become richer. And I think at the very end of this episode, that was what brought the Vaskins and the Curians together, because at the end of the episode, we discover that we are even looking at the Doctor's perspective and all of these events that we think are, you know, first person we're watching are actually a simulation of a anyway, I'm not even going to try to wrap my brain around that, but it's another simulation going back and showing how the discovery of the Doctor's backup module and his bravery and, you know, Corrin's bravery were able to, bring the Vaskins and the Curians together. And they were the building blocks of peace and tranquility for the society. And so I think at the end of the day, Zachary, you know, the takeaway here is there's always more than one way to look at events, and we become richer, I think, when we open our minds and accept facts and willing to look at things from other perspectives, other points of view.
You know, it's interesting. I want to think more about this, but the connection between, you know, thinking about history and thinking about genealogy for me is an interesting one, because I've kind of found ways of finding new meaning for my own life based on my connection to people that came before me and some sort of long-term kind of historical trend of a family or a narrative or whatever. And in some way, that gives my life meaning. And it's similar to the question that Dr. Sung asks Data in that episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation. I'm so bad at remembering episode titles, but the episode where Dr. Sung triggers a homing device and Data kind of hijacks the ship and goes to meet Dr. Sung for the first time, and Dr. Sung asked Data these questions. You know, why do people have children and whatnot? It's, well, to give their lives meaning, right? This connection between the past and the projection of ourselves into the future is a way of finding meaning for our lives. So in my mind, it's right to keep looking back to the past as a way of finding meaning in the present. It's part of living a life, I think, and finding meaning in the here and now is finding meaning in the past and projecting yourself and your hopes or in the future. It could be literally your own future. It could be generations in the future. Looking back at past events in your own life or past events in the history of your society or in the history of your family or whatnot. Those are all ways of finding meaning in our lives. So it's right in my mind for any society to keep circling back and finding meaning in the past and interpreting it in light of the present and in light of the future. I think we're a unique kind of being that has the ability to think temporally in that way, and not all life forms seem to have that long-term temporal perspective on their own existences. So it's a very kind of human question for me. And as you were talking a second ago, I was thinking that, you know, when I first started this episode tonight, I was thinking that there are sort of two types of historical disagreements. There's factual disagreements and interpretive disagreements. And now that we've talked it out a little bit, I think that maybe there's at least three types of disagreements. I think maybe I found a subtle nuance there. Certainly there are factual disagreements. So in this episode, you know, the character who gets killed on Voyager is it's a factual question. Chetrin, thank you. Who pulled the trigger, right? That's a purely factual question. Mm-hmm. What actual event happened? And then there's disagreements about context, right? What else was going on? What kind of nuances surrounded that event? And that is a kind of a deeper tapestry level question, right? What was the surrounding context and why did that event happen the way it did? And that's a question of context. And then there's the question of meaning and interpretation. What did that event mean for us as a society? What does it mean for our future? What does it mean for our race? Whatever, right? And so now I've sort of realized there's kind of three types of historical questions, maybe more. I'm sure an actual historian could shed a little more light on this than we can. But, there's disagreements of fact. There's disagreements about context, which is sort of a deeper sense of fact, right? What else was going on that give that allowed that event to make sense? And then there's the question of interpretation. What's the meaning of that event? And you can see all of those types of disagreements going on inside this episode. But I think it's also easy to conflate them, right? Who pulled the trigger is different from what else was going on, is different from what does that event mean? And I think when you're thinking about historical evidence and how to weave together the best tapestry you can of a historical account, it's important to really keep those questions separate and make sure you don't forget any of them. I think all of those are important questions. It's easy to not think about the interpretation, and that leads to boring history. It's easy to not think about context, and that leads to overly simplistic facts that don't make sense. And you have to take all these into account. And so history is more complex than just names and dates. I think that's the long and the short of it.
Yeah, I was going to say your Venn diagram got a little more complex.
Yeah, now it's a three-circle Venn diagram. Exactly. Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about living witness and historical evidence today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
It would be a lot of fun to be able to MST3K an episode like Arena, which who doesn't love poking fun at a rock-throwing Gorn? I mean, come on, you know?
Can you find a rudimentary lathe?
Exactly. I wrote that on the Babel conference today because Guy Fliegman from Galaxy Quest is the greatest character ever.
Earl Grey.
This 547 meter long, 32 deck, 502 crew member.
That's awesome.
To the journey!
Now we go to Once Upon a Time.
Neelix tries to...
Warp 5.
If they could have kind of told us, it's more of a future for us, but we're going to build up to the Star Trek you know. And Larry's comment back was, well, that would mean that they kind of were planning it out and they knew what they were doing ahead of time.
Buzzing.
That sounds right. Like Larry.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
I will say, if you want to see what it's really like when someone slices open a tauntaun to get inside to stay warm, like in the real world.
Yeah.
That was the best part of the movie. I'm like, really? Han Solo made it look so easy. This is what happens? This is terrifying.
The 602 Club.
It's about that transformation of getting Oliver to be able to see themselves as something more than vigilantes, but being heroes.
Yeah, and there is a lot of... I like that because there is a lot in the quote unquote, as you're calling it, the island story, which the island now is Hong Kong, as you pointed out.
Yeah,
earlier.
I mean, yeah, it's a little bigger than an island.
Literary Treks.
Dan, are you sure that flavor isn't something like a green liquid voodoo drink?
Oh, man. This.
Because that could be the flavor that we're going for. Boy.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all of the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTrex, you can contact us in several different ways. You can find us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
Or you can leave us a voicemail. Look at the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @trekfm.
You can also find us on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/trekfm. Check out the Babel Conference while you're there. Just type the Babel Conference. That's B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trekfm and click discussion on the menu bar. That is our listeners-only discussion group. So join us at Babel and get in on the conversation.
We also invite you to leave a rating and review of MetaTrex on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you are not piecing together the history of the Federation from historical evidence, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs these days?
Zachary, you can find me on Facebook. I'm certainly around the Babel Conference. You can also find me on Twitter. My username is @cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're not creating reasonable extrapolations of history, where can our listeners find you?
Well, likewise, you can find me on Facebook in Trek FM's listeners group, the Babel Conference. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search engine, and you can find the Trek FM listener group there if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, Zachary Fruhling. That's Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y-F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTrex team from the network, specifically C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek FM, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Will Wynn, our content manager, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Dennis Costello, our editor and producer. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of MetaTrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.